everybody. Welcome to another Comic Boom Comic Source collaboration. It's your DC Spotlight for March 5th, 2024. Really good week this week. For those of you who maybe were looking for my Tom King, Daniel Sampere interview last week, apologies. Life happened and we had to move it. So we actually recorded it Monday, same day we're rocking and actually recording this. So it'll be out early this week. Apologies. I was hoping to have it up on, do the interview on Thursday and put it up on Friday. But like I said, we couldn't even get together, Daniel, Tom, and I until today. So that's coming. So look for that. There's a lot of fantastic insights and we had a lot of fun and laughing and what have you, talking about Wonder Woman. But yeah, I thought really good week. That being said, my book of the week was a really easy pick. And I guess we'll see if Rocky's yeah. was as well. But not because anything else was bad, but just because one of the books really blew me away. So anyway, what were your feelings about the week overall, Rocky?
Well, it was an eventful week. There's some comic books where significant events take place, and some of them were really good. Overall, I think this was a week where there are a number of events, at least three comics for sure, possibly four, depending on how much of you're a fan of those particular characters, that something significant happens in the comic and it's worth talking about. And I'm really curious to hear your thoughts. I think I know what your pick of the week is going to be. And I might be inclined to agree with you, but you know what? I always find that sometimes after hearing your thoughts in combination with my own, sometimes I end up changing my mind. So it's always good to shoot the shit with you when we review these comics, my friend.
Yeah. So let's dive right into it. First up, Suicide Squad, Kill Arkham Asylum. Issue number 2, written by John Layman. Art is by Jesus Arvas. David Barron is the colorist. Letters by Andrel Design. So this is the book that ties in with the Suicide Squad Kill the Justice League video game. And the first issue, I think most notably, the thing that stuck out in my mind, the thing that I remember, well, two things. It was a fun book, and I did enjoy it. I do recall that. The other thing that I recall was Amanda Waller looked so weird. Like, I've never seen her rendered before. That continues in this book. When she's on the page, I'm just like, it looks like a skinny African-American male, not anything like what Amanda Waller would look like. But different artists have different interpretations. And yeah, there she is if you're watching this on YouTube. Just that, whatever. It doesn't look anything like Amanda Waller has ever looked. But be that as it may, the thing that I want to mention about this book is I don't think you need to know anything about the Arkham Knight series of Batman video games. You don't need to be or plan on playing this the Suicide Squad Kills the Justice League video game. This is just a fun comic on its own. Does it tie in real well with like current continuity? No, not at all. But it doesn't need to. This is clearly kind of its own world, its own continuity. We get the African-American Deadshot, you know, sort of more based on the Will Smith. I mean, it doesn't really look like Will Smith, but again, I'm kind of glad it doesn't. But it's more kind of rooted in that DC cinematic universe. And there's humor here from John Layman. There's a ton of action, and it doesn't pull any punches. I mean, we saw in the first issue, King Shark just eat somebody. In this one, like, people's heads are getting whacked off by Harley's hammer. Like, this is, you know, it's not for kids, as it were. This is for mature readers, even though it's not, you know, necessarily Black Label. There's a lot of violence, but it's a prison break in Arkham Asylum. You would expect there to be violence. You would expect some level of depravity from these prisoners when they are released, because we're told early on, the first couple pages, it's a whole brand new day with Amanda Waller in charge. You know, she's actively going out there, kind of like Florida, and recruiting officers who have complaints against them for excessive violence. You know, she comes right out and says, hey, all those things that got you in trouble out there on the outside, that's what we want here. You want to stomp some heads for no other reason, even if you don't think they deserve it. This is the worst of the worst that are in here. They deserve it in some way, shape, or form. So it's a little fascist in that way. And again, Amanda Waller saying the quiet part out loud, she's completely a villain. She belongs in Arkham Asylum. For all the horrible things that she's done. But clearly this is its own thing. Layman is taking it seriously. And even if you're not into the video games or what have you, this is a good story. You don't need to know any of that continuity. You don't need to know any of the what's gone on before. This stands on its own. And interesting that, you know, Waller is preaching this whole idea that nobody gets into Arkham Asylum that I don't want. Nobody gets out of Arkham Asylum that I don't want. But it's clear that she has orchestrated this prison break herself and really thrown her guards, these guards that tortured these prisoners. She's thrown them to the wolves, like kind of literally, because as soon as they get out, of course, these depraved criminals are going to be looking for revenge. And who can blame them, right, with the way they were tortured by these prison guards. So interesting story. Kind of mature in terms of violence or what have you. But I think it works. I enjoyed it. What'd you think, Rocky?
Yeah, I enjoyed it too. And I know that I don't play video games, so I've never played Suicide Squad Kills the Justice League, but I watched the video game movie on YouTube, and it was pretty cool. I quite liked it. I know some people were complaining about it for all kinds of reasons, which I pretty much disagreed with all of them, but because I loved it, I thought it was fantastic, and it's enjoyable as hell to watch. And it's easy to see how this fits in, because while there's chaos happening in Metropolis, while this Arkham Asylum breakout is occurring, and we know from the video game that what's really happening is Brainiac has brainwashed the Justice League and made them evil. And Amanda Waller knows that and she's using the chaos of what's happening around the world regarding the Justice League to basically break out to see who's going to survive when there's chaos at Arkham Asylum. And ultimately, she's going to be recruiting the survivors of the people that survived the breakout at Arkham to recruit the Suicide Squad to kill the Justice League, which leads into the events of the video game. And it's fantastic here. What I particularly like, and it's funny, is that I like the rapport here between, or rather the lack of rapport between Deadshot and Deathstroke. And, you know, it's interesting. One thing we never got in the DC Cinematic Universe that maybe at some point in the future we will. We never really got. We got to see Deathstroke in the Marvel Cinematic. In the DC Cinematic Universe, we got to see Deathstroke, but only a glimpse of him at the end of Batman v Superman. And we got to see Deadshot, Will Smith's Deadshot in Suicide Squad, but we never really saw them two of them meet up in any way. And I like here, there is a rivalry here between Deadshot and Deathstroke, and there's a history between the two of them. And of course, it looks as if Deadshot really is better than Deathstroke, and he got the best of Deathstroke when they first met, but Deathstroke won't admit that. And at the end, Deadshot and Deathstroke are breaking out along with another inmate, and Deathstroke betrays Deadshot at the end here. But it's going to be clear here, and what I love about it is we know that people are going to die, and I have a sneaking suspicion that Deathstroke is probably going to die at the hands of Deadshot at some point, and I'm looking forward to it, even though John Layman is maybe playing with that trope of the fun of being able to play in the sandbox and kill whoever he wants, and it's happening. There's gore, there's death, there's decapitation here. I love it, and I love Harley with the hammer. This is full bore. This is the type of rated R stuff that I like, and John Layman is he's having fun. And I'm not that I know John Layman's. I think he's wrote in Shoon. He's wrote in a few other offbeat titles that I don't know if I'm really familiar. I don't know if he's done a lot of superhero work, to my knowledge. Maybe he has, but I'm enjoying this, and this is a lot of fun. I'm enjoying this along with Justice League, the King Kong v Godzilla. A lot of these out of continuity titles, I'm really quite enjoying. So yeah, I recommend this title for people who, if you're tired and you don't want to get too tied up in DCU continuity, don't worry about it, man. Pick up this Suicide Squad Kills Arkham Asylum, and you'll have a lot of fun.
Yeah, Layman, I think he hasn't done a ton of work at DC. He's done some great Spawn stuff and has a Spawn series upcoming. Spawn kills everything, basically. But I remember Layman, like, they really pushed him as the next writer for Detective Comics at one point in the New 52. And he kind of, along with James Robinson, became part of that group that, you know, they were announced. I think Andy Diggle on Action Comics as well. They were all announced as taking over. And then that was right around the time where the New 52 was kind of struggling, and it was such heavy editorial influence. And there was a bunch of people that were promoted and marketed as being on the books that never actually took over. Layman was a part of that. Maybe one, two issues. But yeah, he hasn't done extensive superhero work, but he's a fantastic guy. And yeah, his work on Chew kind of, you know, stands on its own. Okay, up next, speaking of Batman, we have Batman First Night. I should say The Batman First Night, written by Dan Jurgens, art and cover by Mike Perkins, colors by Mike Spicer, letters by Simon Bolan. I hope that you all got a chance to hear my chat with Dan Jurgens and Mike Perkins last week. We talked extensively about this title, about the creative choices that they were making and what this title is. Even though it's Black Label, set in the past in the 1930s, Dan mentioned he went out of his way not to contradict anything. And really, when you go back and read those Golden Age stories, I mean, a lot of times they're 8, 10, 12 pages. There's not a lot. They're not sophisticated. There's not a lot of things being fleshed out. It's not like, the story, more complicated storytelling, more realistic storytelling and characterization of comics today. So it's really easy to go back and write a story that doesn't contradict anything and adds to the origin of Batman and what have you. So in this story, Batman, very early on in his career, there's no Alfred, there's no, real kind of bat cave, bat computer, that sort of thing. He's kind of learning the ropes, as it were, just getting started. We see kind of the first meeting between Batman and Commissioner. He's not even Commissioner. He's just Detective Gordon in this book. And you get that sense that this is early on, but this is not like this is the most original idea, right? Let's go back and tell the story early in Batman's career, Batman Year One or Batman the Night or whatever. What was the one that Tom Taylor did, Batman the Detective? That was early on as well. But anyway, what kind of sets this apart is kind of the attention to detail in the art of going back and saying, yes, it is the 1930s, right? I mean, so often you talk about, we're just talking about the New 52, what have you, and saying, okay, this is Batman early on in his career, but it's kind of modern times, right? This whole idea that the whole DC timeline, it's this sliding scale that's moving forward where everyone as a hero basically appeared between 5 and 10 years ago. This is not that. This is still saying, yes, Batman appeared in the 1930s, coming out of the roaring 20s. We had the Great Depression, worldwide depression, hunger, and a lot of different aspects, a lot of poverty, especially in the cities. Kind of the first time we had people that were homeless and what have you. And this idea that Gotham suffered along with a lot of other major U.S. cities. And again, Dan and Mike talk a lot about wanting to get the era right, get the feel right. And if you're watching us on YouTube, Rocky's got this page, and we talked about this page, myself and the creators, and how, in the midst of this dirty, gritty urban environment, there you have Bruce Wayne, right? Still has his fortune, born with, multiple silver spoons in his mouth. And he's kind of untouched and sort of looks like he's above it all with his bright, shiny sports car and what have you. Whereas other people are struggling even to make ends meet, to have anything to eat at night. And so, in this environment, we're talking about a kind of a different sort of Batman and a different sort of villain. And again, Dan going back and to the earliest times of Batman and pulling in a lot of the things that were mentioned back then, but then fleshing them out to tell a more modern story. It's just brilliant. It's just brilliant. And the colors by Mike Spicer that kind of capture those two worlds, the world of Batman. And in the story, there's some more well-to-do citizens, some more higher profile citizens that are being killed and who's behind it and that sort of thing. And then you have the specter of, you have the Great War having ended, World War One, the late 19-teens and, into the early 1920s. But you also have the specter of World War II. About to start as we're coming to the end of the 30s here, Hitler's rising in power, Nazi Germany, fascism, that sort of thing. That's mentioned as well, the kind of the political climate. So again, I encourage everybody, go listen to the interview I did with Dan and Mike. It was absolutely fantastic. And pick up this book because it's gorgeous. I can say unequivocally, this is my favorite Mike Perkins art that I've ever seen. Like he just nails it. And he talks about it in our chat as well, how he's got a little bit more space on the page and it's kind of a double-edged sword. It gives the art more room to breathe, but he finds himself, oh, I've got more space. But I've got more space. That's kind of the way that he put it, right? So he could fit more stuff on there, but you still have to be restrained. You still have to make sure you're not putting too much in these pages. But I thought it was brilliant. Really, really well done. What do you think of it, Rocky?
Well, I love the art. Mike Perkins, I mean, you and I have, I think everything he's done, he manages to bring something different, whether it's a Swamp Thing or whether it was even on the series with, he did a 10-issue series, Lois Lane with Greg Rucka, that I liked his rendition of Lois Lane there. Whether it was Swamp Thing, I thought it was really well. Did he do some Constantine? Regardless, I mean, it's just good stuff. And this is, I mean, I agree with you. The background here is what really, the setting here is just incredible. This is, this feels like what's Gotham City in 1939. And I like how right off the bat through a series of newspapers, beautifully illustrated by Spicer. I mean, Mike Perkins is Dan Jurgens does just a fantastic job of getting us right in the heat of the late 1930s. We're basically, it's 1939. Throughout this entire narrative, we get references to Lou Gehrig, songs by Billie Holiday, numerous references, of course, of coming out of the Great Depression, of setting the tone of, this is even within a few months of the Nazi Party's meeting at Madison Square Garden. So Nazism is on the rise in the United States the communist movement is on the rise. America is going through a great period of change. And because a lot happens, I mean, post-war America is very different than pre-war World War II America. And Dan Jurgens does a fantastic job of capturing the mood and the essence of that. And in the midst of this, we have a murder of a councilman. And right away, we're delved into investigation. We got Commissioner Gordon here who's doing the investigation. These councils... more than one councilman has been killed, and all of them seem to have known Bruce Wayne. Bruce Wayne's very good friends with Commissioner Gordon, and I like how Jurgens sort of replaces the relationship. Alfred's not even on the playing field. Apparently, when Bruce Wayne was in his college years, Alfred took off. Where did Alfred go? Is Alfred going to make an appearance in this story? We don't know. But it almost seems like the person that replaced Alfred as sort of his mentor was Jim Gordon himself, who basically remembers sort of helping a young boy whose parents were murdered in front of him. And so the relationship between Gordon and Bruce Wayne is a different kind of relationship. Different formation. It formed differently than the traditional sort of mainstream Batman story, and combine that with this really does have the feel like 1940s or late 1930s Hollywood as well. In fact, Bruce Wayne is funding a movie, Night of the Thousand Cuts. There's like movie stars, and he's funding a movie while at the same time he's in his quasi. He doesn't have a Batcave, but he tracks the fingerprints, or he manages some fingerprints that he has Gordon check out on. And it appears as if these people, the person whose prints they belong to, is not even alive. So maybe this person, this villain, might be a corpse, might be the Walking Dead. And so it's eerie, it's horrific, and it really makes you wonder what is going on. And of course, Bruce Wayne's relationship to the city of Gotham is sort of interesting as well. He's sort of a playboy. He's sort of looked down upon, and yet at the same time, he does. I like the feel that it has. I really do. I like the feel that it has. And it's clear that Bruce Wayne is somebody who he's got a confidence about him that seems to be different. He doesn't seem to be quite as grim and gritty as the Batman we're all accustomed to. He reminds me of Gregory Peck. The way Mike Spicer draws him Mike Perkins draws him, he looks, reminds me of the movie star Gregory Peck in some of the scenes. And I thought, I don't know if that was intentional or if that's just what I'm seeing when I look at Bruce Wayne, but I thought just excellent between the story, the narrative, and with Perkins and Spicer setting the mood with the art. I think it's really, really good and definitely a candidate for pick of the week. No question.
Yeah. I think, you mentioned that him not having that dark and gritty, it's almost like he hasn't got to the point where he's decided Bruce Wayne needs to be the mask and he's Batman all the time. You know, we talk about that a lot, kind of a more modern trope of Batman. And yeah, he hasn't gotten there yet. So really interesting. All right. Up next, we have Neil Before Zod, issue number 3. Joe Casey is the writer. Dan McDade on art. David Barron on colors. Troy Petrie on letters. Give us your thoughts on this one, Rocky.
This is definitely a whopper of an issue. Speculator alert. There is a major death here. At least it's a major death to me as a Superman fan and as a Zod fan. And as an Ursa fan, God forbid you're an Ursa fan, you might be a little upset with what happens this week. Zod has, in Ursa, in his wife's opinion, Zod's lost his touch. He's not as megalomaniac, maniacal as he should be. He's not as aggressive as he should be. And Ursa basically told him to kneel before Zod. And probably what is probably my cover of the week, which I just love. Ursa's got Zod by the chin, squeezing it while his eyes are looking like they're all red, and she's telling him to kneel. I mean, you got to wonder what's going on in that scene. But it's clear here that Ursa wants Zod to be more aggressive against the Kuns, because the alien race, the Kuns, are invading New Kandor, and they're using a very aggressive tactics. And this entire issue, what I love about it is Joe Casey's scripts. A battle. The whole issue is just one giant battle, and it really tests the art of Dan McDade, who does a really good job, and David Barron on the colors. It's visceral, it's action-packed, it's bloody, it's gory. I mean, Ursa, I mean, any doubt as to how Ursa feels about the enemy, I mean, she basically decapitates, removes the head off an enemy. I mean, even the Kuns are saying that they're fighting an enemy that is heartless they refer to the Kryptonian tactics as sadistic and cruel. And these are the Kuns talking. I mean, normally when we DC fans, we know when we see the Kuns in any battle, in any space battle in the DC universe, regardless of what comic it's in, Kuns are known for their deplorable, merciless tactics. And yet they pales in comparison when they go up against Zod and Ursa. And there's only two of them. And it just really goes to show you just how powerful Kryptonians are. And this is only two Kryptonians against an entire Kund armada, which is essentially, attacking New Kandor. And ultimately, they end up having to use the ultimate weapon, which temporarily turns the yellow sun, which gives Zod and Ursa their powers, turns it red, and it strips them and weakens them of their powers. Just as they launch a major attack, which is only temporary, and it's temporary enough that Zod manages to get his powers back in time. But unfortunately, Ursa can't say the same thing, and Ursa ends up with quite graphically losing her life. And Ursa dies in this issue as she lived, basically fast, brutal, and without mercy. So no one can say Ursa never got what she got coming to her, but she went out like she lived her life, and she probably went out, I'm sure, with no regrets, because that's who Ursa was. And Joe Casey, he did state that this was about bringing Zod back in all his glory, and a full bore, full angry Zod, and boy, you can see how this issue would do that, because last issue, Ursa basically put Zod in his place and made it clear that she was disappointed in him. He's got to be more aggressive. He's got to man up to be the man she married, essentially. I'm paraphrasing him with my own words. But they never really got to have that conversation. Before they could really have it, this issue occurs. And there's probably so much left unsaid between Zod and Ursa. And then when you think in the larger ramifications, think of the son of, Lars Zod with their son, who never got to say goodbye to his mom, and how that's going to affect him in the Sinister Sons when he ultimately finds out, how that's going to affect, undoubtedly dysfunctionally, the relationship between Zod and his son. The ramifications of this issue are immense. The ramifications of the threat that Zod poses to the larger United Planets, the larger universe. Zod was more or less tolerant of the United Planets, but he was working within the confines of the rules of the United Planets. He just didn't like how they were being, even Zod thought they weren't aggressive enough dealing with the Kuns. Now Zod, what is Zod going to be like? Is Zod going to be, up until this point, I would have guessed that Sinestro was probably the biggest threat to peace in the amongst the United Planets. Sinestro and Kurgar. And now we got Zod, a new Kandor, who's, I'm sure, going to go absolute, he's going to go insane as he ultimately at the end of this issue. We know that we got the Sinister Sons, and they can get into a lot of trouble, but they're just kids. They're juvenile delinquents. You know, when we've got, you know, Sin Sun and, you know, Lor Zod, okay, no big deal. They're teenagers. Maybe they can be dealt with. But if you got Sinestro and you got Zod, I'm not saying that's where the story's going, but I like what this means for the larger cosmic aspect of the DC universe. It needs more threats. And I like Zod as being another evil, potentially evil, conquering wild card, along with the complex character of Sinestro, because it adds more complexity to the United Planets and to the intergalactic politics that can lead to some really great stories. So I thought this was really well done. If I'm really being nitpicky, there were some scenes where, I mean, I thought the art was consistent and it did its job and I thought it was really good, but I can also think that there are other aspects where the art, you know, I couldn't help but think of different styles of how this, I pictured some of these scenes, but I got to give full props to Dan McDade here because he brought his A game, and this is probably his best drawn issue to date. And you could see the anger that Zod had and I would have wished to had a little bit more of seeing what Ursa was going through, because we never really saw Ursa's final moments. We just saw the result of that final moment. But I would have liked to have seen Ursa. I would have liked to have seen more of that scene take place. But because we didn't, we're robbed of seeing Ursa's final moments, just like Zod is robbed. And that heightens the emotion that Zod feels, because he not only, Ursa dies, not only in Zod's eyes, he not only failed to meet the expectations of his beloved, but she died, gave her life for him, and he wasn't even there to protect her. So he failed to protect her, and he failed to live up to her expectations. What does that do to a man who now literally has lost everything? And he's also lost his son, who may not ever come back, and that might forever remain dysfunctional. So kudos to Joe Casey here for really setting up what could be a very interesting set of dynamics moving forward.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the issue as well. And I couldn't help but think about, so just to be clear, everybody, a couple weeks ago, so maybe a week after we reviewed the previous issue of Zod, I got a press release from DC about, you know, major death, you know, Ursa's going to die in the next issue, what have you. And I had no details about how it would happen. And all I could think of was, oh, Rocky was right. Because I sort of felt like, and especially having talked to Joe Casey at San Diego Comic-Con, that interview's up on the channel if you want to go, the podcast channel if you want to go listen to it. But him saying, yeah, we're going to make Zod evil again. And all I could think was, you know, Ursa was raking him over the coals last issue. Is he going to just snap and we're going to get like a woman in the refrigerator moment where Zod's going to be responsible for killing Ursa? Like, it sort of felt like maybe that could happen. I mean, you want to talk about making a guy evil. You know, I don't know how well it plays, you know, politically these days, but yeah, it would be super evil for you want to really make sure everybody knows this guy is a piece of crap. That's the way you go. It turns out it didn't happen that way. It's almost the exact opposite, right? She gets killed, even though you can make the argument that the Kuns kind of did it in self-defense because, like Rocky mentioned, Zod and Ursa were, you know, two people were just dismantling the Kun, you know, invasion force with the power. It goes to show how powerful Kryptonians are. So you kind of can't blame them, but at the same time, should they have been there? I mean, you know, mutual combat. There's any different way you could debate it on whether it was deserved or not. But the fact of the matter is Zod looks distraught in that final panel. There's no dialogue or anything, but it looks like, you know, he's up at the sky, you know, yelling, screaming, no, or whatever. Clearly, there were feelings there for Ursa, which goes back to why I thought it was a little interesting. I don't know, and I talked to Joe about this at San Diego, not in the interview, but after, about how as much as I don't like when DC takes villains and makes them heroes, it never really did that with Zod. I feel like Zod stayed pretty true to his character. Really, he's just looking for another world for Krypton, and he has that now. And so I didn't necessarily ascribe or agree with what Laura was saying or what Ursa was saying. They're giving Zod a bad time. He's doing what he wants to be doing. He's creating a new world. He's creating a new Krypton. They're like, you're not feared anymore or whatever. I'm like, isn't that growth? Like, what's the end? I think I even mentioned it when we reviewed the last issue. What's the end game? Like, you do all those despicable things to get to the end game to say, okay, I'm doing all these horrible things so that I can establish a new Krypton. You know, I can make a world for us or whatever. Yeah, his behavior might be different. He might be kind of mellowing because his job has changed. He's hit that goal. He doesn't need to be a complete scumbag. Now he needs to be maybe more of a diplomat or maybe more of like a politician to kind of rule the planet. Being ruthless to get the planet was one thing. Now he's got the planet. His role's kind of changing. But, you know, Lord Zod and Ursa are both like, no, you're not, you know, where's the man I married? You don't strike fear in the hearts of anybody or what have you. It's like, so are you saying he just needs to be evil for the sake of being evil? And he can't ever have peace and a home life or whatever. Like, I just felt bad. But regardless of that, regardless of whether Ursa was justified and what Zod was thinking or what have you, a brilliant job by Joe Casey to just rip Ursa away, right? You mentioned it. Lore left. He's lost his son. He may never come back. Who knows? We don't know where that story is going to go. And now he's lost his beloved, this woman that, you know, you never really think of Zod as kind of lovey-dovey, like he really cared about his wife, whatever. But he did – I mean, one of the things while Ursa was raking him over the coals last issue, you did see him kind of taking it to heart. So he clearly cared about her opinion. So, you know, that would intimate that he's got some strong feelings for her. And now – brilliantly done, brilliantly illustrated by Dan McDade when he comes across her, you know, body here stabbed with all those laser swords and what have you. And I go back to that final panel where he's just – the anguish on his face, like – you could look at it one of two ways. He really and truly did love her in the deepest sense of the word. You know, a lot of us that are married or have kids or, you know, significant other can relate to that. And hopefully not the feeling of loss, but you know, you can imagine what it would be like to lose the person that mattered the most. Or you could really spin it the other way in terms of how despicable Zod is and how dare the cunts do this to me. It's not that I cared about her so much. It's that she was like, look what you did to me. This is something that belongs to me. You have injured Zod. You know what I mean? Yeah. I tend to lean more toward the first part, but I can see the second part as well. The second part would be more of a Terrence Stamp, Superman 2 type of characterization for the character. He really doesn't care about anybody but himself, but how dare you, do something to Zod's wife. So we'll see. We'll see how it all plays out. But he has lost his two anchors. He's lost, you know, what I was mentioning before about him maybe wanting to settle down and him reaching the goals and wanting to build a new Krypton for his wife, for his son, so they can – well, now he's lost that. He's lost the reason that he maybe would have mellowed out. So now why not just go – like, I could see him going completely like Dark Phoenix, right? Like, you know, Dark Phoenix goes out there, destroys whole planets. Would Zod not just be like, okay, I'm going to go out there and just commit genocide against the Kuns? Like, every Kun planet, every Kun citizen, every Kun warrior, whatever, I'm going to kill them all. And I don't care who tries to stop me. There will not be a Kun left anywhere in the DC. Like, I could see Zod doing that. That could become like Zod's mission. And then obviously you're going to have the people that say, hey, you know, there's innocent Kuns. I mean, are there though? I mean, they're such a warlike race. You mentioned it. They always are depicted as so warlike and despicable and deplorable. And they were even saying, oh my God, look what these Kryptonians are doing to us. So that was done brilliantly as well. I totally agree there. So yeah, by far and away, my favorite issue of the series so far. Wasn't what I expected to get Zod back to the place where maybe Joe Casey thought he always should have been as this really evil dude. But yeah, he took the status quo of where Zod was and has created a situation where it makes complete sense. He's got no anchor. He's got no reason to hold back. He's got no reason not to be the most evil son of a bitch in the whole DC universe, galaxy, whatever, right?
Yeah, look,
I could see him like going and taking on Darkseid. Hey, Darkseid, I want your power so I can use your power to wipe out the Coons. Like, I could see him doing something like that. Like, he's gonna go all out. Yeah, it's really exciting. In a totally horrible, horrible way that this would happen, but really exciting that where the story is going to lead. Okay, up next we have Shazam number 9, Creeped Out. Mark Waid and Emanuela Lupacchino listed as storytellers. Lupacchino obviously on art, Waid handling more of the narrative duties. Trish Mulvihill on colors, Troy Petrie on letters. There's kind of not much to the story. I can just tell you it's a Captain Marvel or Shazam and Creeper team up. And that's kind of all you need to know. It's fun. It's sort of timeless in the storytelling. Great art from Lupacchino. Really good color work as well. Waid's good at telling these type of stories where they do feel timeless and it's not kind of a slave to continuity. Really bright, vibrant colors from Mulvihill. The only little nitpick I have is I don't remember Jack Ryder, he was this way a little bit in Danger Street, but that's a Black Label out of continuity book. I just don't remember him being such a dick. And credit to Waid for kind of giving an in story explanation of why he's acting like this. But it just felt weird to me in the beginning. I just don't remember him being such a jerk. But overall, it's a fun story. These Shazam titles have been very continuity light throughout these Shazam issues, and I've really enjoyed that. And it's part of the reason that I'm sad that Mark Waid is leaving the title so that he can go and concentrate on the Absolute Power event, which I'm excited for. So it's like, I get it, right? He's writing a ton of those Absolute Power. We mentioned, I think there's like 27 issues or something with all the minis and whatever. So you can understand why he doesn't have the bandwidth to do this. And Josie Campbell's the one that's going to come on Shazam and take over the writing duties. And she's done a fantastic job with the Shazam stories and Shazam family stories she's told in the past. So the character's going to be in good hands. I am a little bit sad to see that Mark Waid is leaving, but this issue is a perfect example of why, because he's just so great at telling these kind of one and done story. Like, this is a one and done story. And it's engaging. It doesn't feel rushed. It doesn't feel like an incomplete story, but it feels like a complete story. It feels like something actually happened. And it's great to see the old Hawkman Shadow Thief villain. Most people, Shadow Thief is kind of associated as a Hawkman villain. So great to see him. I'm a huge fan of the Creeper. Love the Creeper as a character. This was a big win for me. What do you think of it?
Yeah, for a one-shot story, this is just remind me of a modern-day Silver Age tale or modern-day story with Silver Age sensibilities, to use that term. And Mark Waid's a master. If no one knows the Silver Age of DC Comics, arguably better than Mark Waid, and he shows he knows what he's doing here. And I have to say, I love the art of Emanuela Lupacchino. It's just perfect because she has that way of just conveying just the big, bright, hopeful sort of looking characters that look that there's some body hope, and they're just full bodied, good expressions, great action, and it really pulls you into the story. And what I particularly like how Mark Waid incorporates social media, and at one point in here, Jack Ryder, is interviewing Billy Batson, and he says, you come to discover that it was all just basically a ploy by Jack Ryder, who he suspected Billy Batson was Shazam, but he lured him in by giving him an interview, but then when he had him in his car, I love how he tricks Billy Batson into saying Shazam, because he tells Billy Batson that, well, sincerity is a plague in our profession. We're podcasters or interviewers, and sincerity is hard to come by. And Jack Ryder kind of brags that he he puts on an act. He's sort of an asshole on his news broadcast, because that's just the role that he plays, because that way people can vicariously live through him and express their negativity and cynicism through his voice. And I think a lot of people would probably agree with Jack Ryder. And if they don't, I would call bullshit, because there's a lot of negativity out there in comic book YouTube, to say the very least. And sometimes I admit I contribute to that. But, you know, God bless us all. It's just the nature of the beast. But I like the fact that he tells Billy that, you know, he practices, he does these vocal exercises to get better at speaking. And he, part of the vocal exercises, Billy Batson tries them. He says the words Kenosha and then Zambia and then Kenosha, Zambia, and he tricks him into saying Shazam, and then he basically wants Shazam's help to go after the shadow thief, who, instead of stealing jewelry, is kidnapping people of this World Fiduciary Council and then blackmailing them to sell them for cryptocurrency. And ultimately, Shazam, Billy Batson, uses the wisdom of Solomon to defeat and reveal the shadow thief by changing and converting, transforming into Shazam and back to Billy, et cetera, et cetera. And it works. And it's Jack Ryder gets his comeuppance at the end, because he insults not only Billy Batson, but Metamorpho one too many times. And it's just a really good story with a great ending. And the good guys win. And even the good guy, the Creeper, who's kind of a jerk, gets sort of a slap in his face at the end, too, courtesy of Metamorpho. So I thought it worked really well. And it was just it's a really enjoyable story. And this is kind of what I expected of Shazam. Most issues, individual one-shots of this is what I almost wish Shazam would be, just a series of one-shots as opposed to a series of, I would prefer stories like this for Shazam as opposed to story arcs, but that's just my bias, because Mark Waid manages to capture just that essence of, I mean, I wish comic books in general had more one-shot stories in general with this caliber that get to the essence of the character and are just fun to read.
Yeah, I agree. It's funny, like, different eras. Basically, at the end of the day, we need diversity. We need some one-shot stories. We need some longer-form stories. You need it all. And, you know, it used to be we had a lot of one-and-dones. Now we hardly ever have any one-and-dones. And everything's long-form. But yeah, I think it's just we need a mixture. It can't be all of one thing and none of the other. So, anyway, let's move on. Up next, we have Batman issue 145, written by Chip Zdarsky. Jorge Jimenez is the artist. Tomoya Morey on colors, Clayton Cowell on letters. So we had the interlude of the three Joker Year One stories. Now we're getting back to the main story. And then there is a backup as well, also written by Zdarsky, Doctor's Orders. Michelle Bandini is the artist on that. Clayton Cowles does the letters with Alex Sinclair on colors. So I admit to having to go back and reread the last issue before the Joker Year One, because I just couldn't remember what happened. But after being reminded, I feel like this story is moving in the right direction. What'd you think, Rocky?
I think it is a little clunky to me. It's a little choppy, but I do understand what he's trying to say. And for the most part, I enjoy it. I want to emphasize that it does have a choppiness and a clunkiness to me that I think the transitions from issue to issue through the Joker's origin of Year One and its sort of sloppy reference to Batman the Night number 8. And just the idea that Dr. Captio is mentored both Bruce Wayne and the Joker, and it's very interesting, but it's very risky too. So on the one hand, I want to give props to DC for taking a chance on this kind of story and taking a chance on Zdarsky telling it. And at the same time, I don't know if it's going to necessarily work with all readers, because here's the thing. Let me give a positive spin on this, because I'm still, the jury's still out of my mind in terms of how I feel about it. I kind of like the idea that Dr. Capia is still alive. We thought the Joker had killed him, but he didn't. Instead, it's revealed here that the Joker has been keeping Dr. Capdi alive for years, basically hidden behind black glass. Like he's basically, Capdi has been the Joker's prisoner, that he's behind glass doors, but glass walls for the longest time. And Capdi has basically been, Capdi has basically been somebody who has been sort of, he's almost like the counselor to the Joker. And every time, and he basically mentors the Joker and has been telling him for years, apparently, that, you know, that Bruce Wayne is going to be, you know, he's created this construct in his mind. He's got this partitioning of the mind, but Bruce Wayne never completed his training. Batman never completed his training. So given the flaws that he has, Bruce Wayne never completing his training. So sooner or later, Xur is right now, for years, Xur is trying to manifest control. And sooner or later, Xur is going to get control. And so what you have to do, Joker, is that because the Joker expresses himself to Dr. Capdia, that, you know, I really like this Xur character. He's like pure Batman. I kind of prefer him to like Bruce Wayne, to the other Batman. And Dr. Capdia tells Joker, well, in order to get that essence of Batman out, you gotta continue to challenge him. You gotta like push the boundaries. And that's what the Joker has always done. And the Joker has pushed those boundaries by doing, among other things, by becoming the Joker of Snyder's Death in the Family, where the Joker ripped his face off, whatever the Joker has done, no matter how extreme, arguably even when he maybe shot Barbara Gordon in Killing Joke, or ripped his own face off under Snyder's Death in the Family, or all the three Jokers, the three Jokers that Batman asked the Morbius chair about. Every different iteration of the Joker, the clown, the psychopath, the whatever, are all the Joker's attempt to pull out Xur, to pull Xur and to encourage Xur to take control of Batman in order to sort of like push the envelope. And that's at least that's how I interpret this. And Dr. Capdia, it's like it's almost like after every adventure that the Joker had with Batman, the Joker would go and, according to the backup, he would talk to Dr. Capdia, who's his captive. And Dr. Capdia will sort of like mentor the Joker and tell him, yeah, you're doing good. This will get Xur out. And Dr. Capdia is fascinated by this. He likes this game that's going on between the Joker and the Batman, because it's a battle between superhuman minds. And Dr. Capdia, he's kind of a sick bastard. He likes the battle that's going, the battle of wits between Batman and the Joker. He's really kind of a cruel, sick bastard in many ways. But he finds it fascinating. It's an experiment, and he's got no problem being apparently held captive by the Joker for years. It's unclear how many years he's been captive by the Joker. And where I think I've got mixed feelings about is, it's hard to imagine that, I mean, if we're to believe this story, we are to believe that the Joker has had Dr. Capdia prison for literally the entire time that the Joker has been an adversary of the Batman. Dr. Capdia has always been the Joker's prisoner. Is that what we are to believe? Because I think that's how I read this. But maybe I read it wrong. Maybe you'll sort of fill in some of the gaps for me if I misread that, or if people listening, when you read it, if you have a different interpretation of this story, please let us know in the comments if you're watching on YouTube. And in any event, I'm fascinated by it. So on the one hand, I think it's kind of cool, because it does actually, albeit maybe with a little bit of messiness, explain not only the three Jokers, but every iteration of the Joker can be justified by the Joker being pushed by Dr. Capdia to do something different. Go to the extra extreme. Oh, you did something really crazy and insane that last time, Joker. Do this now instead. So Dr. Capdia has been behind the scenes. And I think it's going to piss some people off that if you're a Joker fan, the fact that maybe Dr. Capdia, it takes away from the wild card aspect of the Joker. It takes away from the Joker being truly an agent of chaos if Dr. Capdia has always been the one behind the scenes encouraging it. Because it takes away the Joker's agency, which is a word that I know you often use, and I like it because it's true. And I can't believe I'm getting a little upset in defending the Joker here. I kind of wish the Joker's central conceit is that he's a wild card. This sort of suggests that a lot of it is coming at the encouragement of Dr. Capdia, and that's fine, I guess. I'm not sure how I feel about it. So I think this story does work, and I think it does explain everything. And I'm just unsure how I feel about it. I almost wish I could let it percolate in my mind for a couple weeks or another few days before I review it. But I am interested in to see where this is going. But already, I don't mind it. Like, I don't hate it. I kind of like it. I think it's kind of cool. I think it all fits. But I don't know. Maybe I'm curious to hear your thoughts and the thoughts of other people out there, because this is either inspired storytelling or maybe this is going to crash and burn. I still haven't made my mind up yet. What are your thoughts?
Well, I have mixed feelings, right? Partially because it's the Joker and it's my own bias of just being sick of the Joker. This could be the most Joker-centric Batman story ever, right? Like, we have this idea of Zur-En-Arr. We have this idea of the Failsafe. And what Failsafe is doing is so interesting as well. You know, having imprisoned Batman with the Joker. And we're not even exactly sure. Somewhere in the bowels of Gotham City, I'm not even exactly sure where it is, Black Gate or Arkham Asylum or what have you.
Yeah, but, Black Gate, yeah.
Yeah, but then Failsafe pretending to be Bruce, even to the point of having like a video kind of display on his face and showing Bruce's face to the other members of the Bat family saying, hey, it's me, it's Bruce. You know, is he doing that just to be manipulative? Is he doing that because in a way he's trying to convince himself that he is Bruce Wayne and he's going to take a harder line on crime or what have you? That, like, that is this Pinocchio? Is it that Failsafe wants to just be, you know, truly be human, truly be a hero, truly be Batman? Or, you know, is it something more diabolical? Or is it just programming? Is it just ones and zeros, right? Like, that's interesting to me. But getting back to this idea of being super Joker-centric, you know, even that Failsafe being a product of what the Joker did. Like you said, Dr. Capdeo planting the seeds for this way back to when at the point when Bruce was first training. And then being in Gotham City, knowing that, you know, Bruce, when Batman first started showing up, Capdeo's like, oh, that's who Bruce became. And then him going there and having the chance to meet the Joker and seeing the Joker as, you know, antithetical to Batman, the opposite side of the coin, if you will, and him setting this up. And even though, yes, he has been captive, not quite sure how long, as Rocky mentioned, but even the Joker says, yeah, sorry, I'm keeping you captive, but I don't know that there's any other place you'd rather be. I kind of envision him as a spider, right? Capdeo's like this spider in the center of the web, and he wants to see what he's wrought, like what the choices he's made and the kind of the pieces on the board that he has set in place, like see what comes of it, which is really interesting. I do agree with you. It does take a little bit of the Joker's agency away, but not a lot. It's like, okay, partly because of it happening so early, right? With what we saw in the Joker Year One story, where the Joker went to Capdeo and was kind of had the sense of fear, and Capdeo was like, oh, you can't be afraid of Batman or whatever. And then the Joker at the end turned it around. I was never afraid. Like, he was always, as much as Capdeo is kind of manipulating the situation to pit the Joker against Batman, and to explain to Joker that, yeah, you need to pull out this other aspect of his personality, which is the most Batman, if you will, this Zur-En-Arr, the most Batman sort of side of his personality, because that's where you as the Joker will have the most fun. That is where you're mostly the kind of mirror image of him. That's what you want to get at. So it's more Capdeo providing information on it, I think, because it goes back to the earliest time of the Joker before he, you know, once he's fallen in the chemicals, he's still trying to figure out who he is, what he wants to be. And that's when Capdeo was there. Again, it mirrors what Capdeo did for Bruce before he even put on the costume, before he even chose the name of Batman, deciding that he was going to do whatever he could to control his mind, control his emotions and what have you. And we saw that in the Night series. So, like I said, maybe the most Joker-esque story ever. And also goes back to something that you have talked about in the past, Rocky, that some of the people have complained about Zdarsky's run, is intertwining the origins and the motivations of Joker and Batman back to the earliest time, which, you know, it bothers me a little bit too, just because, again, I'm not that much of a Joker fan, and we are inextricably linking these two characters. You can't have Batman without the Joker. You can't have Joker without Batman. I don't know that I, you know, ascribe to that thinking. I just don't like it. I think Batman's more than just the Joker. You know what I mean? Like he's in my mind, he's so much more than that. But that's been the direction it's the story has been going. The other part of this that you mentioned is this idea that everything the Joker's ever done in his career, and again, the timelines get kind of fudgy. I'll talk about that in a little bit. But everything he's ever done has been in service of getting this Zur-En-Ah out. Like, again, this is a retcon that gets a little bit messy. It doesn't always work for motivations for what the Joker is doing. It works in a lot of sense, but doesn't always work. But in terms of timeline, so a couple of things that I'll talk about here. So first of all, forget everything else. Forget how much they're intertwining the origins of these characters and their different careers and what have you. And just think about all the different timelines and even multiversal timelines that we've got in the Zdarsky run, right? Like jumping back to the earliest days of the Joker with Joker Year One, but then the other part of that story was in the future where Batman is old and, you know, physically maybe not able to perform things as he did in the past. The backup in this story, which clearly flashes back to Death of the Family from Scott Snyder's run, which – so that's another thing that I want to mention. So we talk about keeping Captio a prisoner for years. I don't think that Death of the Family story is supposed to be that far into Batman's career. I'd say maybe year two, year three. And we don't know in the present time if Captio is still the prisoner of the Joker. We just know he's a prisoner in the backup, which is sort of around that maybe year two or year three. Still years, still a long time for Captio to be held prisoner. But at least he's still alive, I guess, because like you mentioned, the intimation in this story at the end of Joker Year One was that he was killed. Turns out the Joker just carved like a smile on his face, and that's where the blood came from, I guess, because we see the scars that Captio has here. So yeah, the timelines are hard to make sense of. Can't really think about it too much, but it's also confusing because it does jump around so much, right? We're far in the future. We're at Joker Year One. We're back at the Death of the Family, and then we're also modern times, but then we're also going to jump over and have Batman in this other multiverse where he loses his hand. And that, so I would love to be able to, I mean, Chip would probably never do that. I'm sure I could have Chip come back on the show, but I find that writers, they don't want to just sit down and sort of spoon feed and explain the story. Like I think they feel like if they have to do that, they didn't do their job right. I would never want to insult a writer, but it would be fun. One of these times, you know, some of these writers that tell the stories that are a little more complicated, to kind of sit down with, a beer or a nice glass of whiskey or what have you, you know, maybe in front of the fire and just be, all right, Uncle Chip, tell us a story, like explain, you know what I mean? That's why I like the director's cuts. A lot of times when these books do director's cuts, where you get to see the script or the writers providing a little more context, because I feel like Chip is such a brilliant writer that if he were to, there's some things that we're missing here as readers that may be clear to Chip that might not be as clear to us. And, you know, or, you know, maybe it's just you and I, we read so many comics, it's hard to sometimes remember or put in things into context or what have you. But I am enjoying, as much as this is a Batman, or maybe I should say, as much as this is a Joker story with Batman maybe as a co-star, or maybe even a little bit less of a star. I am enjoying this. I'm curious to see where it all heads. And I am impressed. You know, it doesn't always work. And I won't blame Chip for it because we know, you know, when it comes to DC continuity, these characters have been around for decades. It's a challenge. So I'm not going to blame Chip for the fact that everything doesn't fit together, you know, timeline and continuity wise. Yeah. It is what it is. But it's impressive that he is pulling in so many different eras of DC. And yeah. Although I said, yeah, you can look at everything the Joker's ever done is in service of bringing out Zur-En-Ah. I don't think it works, but a lot of it does, right? Like think back to some of the most iconic Joker moments. Like think back to him deciding to beat Jason Todd to death with a crowbar. That could 100% be like, I'm trying to pull out the most bad. I'm trying to flip that switch. I'm trying to put him through trauma to get him to just let Zur-En-Ah out to play. 100% you beat his sidekick to death with a crowbar. Like that totally works. That totally makes sense.
Yeah.
That's a brilliant job. But I don't think it works for everything. Like how does what Scott Snyder did in Zero Year, you know, I don't know that that fits in necessarily with that motivation. Yeah.
Well, I do find it very interesting that just to add is what Zurinah must really respect Dr. Kapdia, because Zurinah, the Batmaster Zurinah, appoints Dr. Kapdia to be the warden of Blackgate Prison. That's incredible. And yet, so both the Joker and Zurinah Batman highly respect Dr. Kapdia. At least it appears that way. The Joker never killed him, but kept him around for almost counseling all this time to draw out Zur. But now Zur actually likes Dr. Kapdia too, and makes him warden. So the relationship between Zur, Kapdia, and the Joker is very interesting. And I'm not really, it's a highly dysfunctional yet, maybe, I don't know. It's a relationship that I'm not sure where Zardasky's going to go with it. But in the meantime, where does Bruce Wayne fit in all of this? So that's the question I have is that, okay, so the Joker has his wish. He's got Zur. Or the Joker might come to regret that, okay, he's got what he's wished for now. And we know Zurinah is in Failsafe. And we know that Failsafe is going to be with Brainiac and Amanda Waller in Absolute Power. So I think the entire world is probably going to suffer now because of Zurinah in the body of Failsafe. And so, I don't know, it's interesting. So I can't say I'm not intrigued. And I actually find this to be, I'm a little bit excited because I kind of like... I didn't expect this, and I'm kind of glad. So the more I'm talking about it, I'm kind of intrigued as to where this is going to go. But I don't know where it's going to go, but you know, what's that expression from that Quarantino movie? I would say to Zardasky, you had my curiosity, but now you have my attention. He's got my attention now for sure.
Yeah, I think just to name a couple more Joker events that may not necessarily fit in with that narrative. Anytime he teamed up, like back in the 70s and 80s, but again, you know, it's just a different era, but it doesn't make any sense to team up, be part of the Legion of Doom and that sort of thing. But also, we can come more recently and look at the Joker series, which was really a James Gordon series from James Tynan, which we loved. But yeah, so that doesn't... Joker's messing with other people. He's not even messing with Batman. So how does that fit in with Zurinah? Doesn't necessarily make sense. Mm-hmm. But again, that's okay. It's okay. It's okay. We can make, you know, allowances for the fact that, you know, Zdarsky's coming out and doing this later and doing it in a very impressive fashion. So yeah, much like yourself, I'm intrigued to see where it goes. And for all the people, so you remember at the end of Christopher Nolan's Batman trilogy, where Batman supposedly, you know, left and wasn't going to be a part of Gotham City, or actually, I guess it was part two, right? Where he left and they ended up pulling him back for part three. But part two, and people were like, oh, Batman would never do that. He would never just go be off and give up being Batman or whatever. With everything that Zdarsky's putting Bruce through, I feel like this is exactly that's the situation, right? Where you would get a Bruce Wayne. I get his vow, and I get him always wanting to, pay homage to his parents' name by ridding Gotham City of crime. But Jesus Christ, if anybody ever deserved a vacation, it's Bruce after going through all this. Like, poor guys, let him go off and, you know, whoever, Selena, even if it's Selena, I prefer it be Zatanna, but whoever, go off, have a good time, go sit on a beach somewhere, drink some margaritas, because Jesus, man, the guy's been through it. You wouldn't blame him for wanting to take a time out, even if it's for a year or two. But anyway, we've talked Batman to death. Let's move on to Batman adjacent, I suppose. Birds of Prey. So Birds of Prey, issue number 7, Undercover Animals, part 1 of 2. Again, we're not getting a full 6 issue. I love it. Kelly Thompson is the writer. Javier Pena is the artist. Jody Blair on colors. Clayton Cowell on letters. I'll talk about the art first. Javier Pena, this art looks so interesting to me. And I don't know if it was him working with Jordi Belair to give it this interesting texture to his line work that I haven't seen from him before. I almost didn't recognize it as Javier Pena art based on this kind of visceral look. And maybe it's that they wanted to kind of keep it similar to what came previously in the previous issues. With the art style by Leonardo. But either way, I think it really works for this type of story. The color work by Jordi Belair, very, very interesting as well. So So continuing on with what we heard about last issue from this Meridian character, this future version of MAPS Mizuguchi, and the idea that somebody's out traveling through the timeline, out to get Black Canary, and maybe it's revealed in this issue, out to get the Black Canaries in general, because it also appears that somebody's targeting Vixen. Somebody's targeting Mari McCabe. And so I find this to be really interesting, especially if this is going to all play out in only two issues. I'm all for it. We still get the great characterization from Kelly Thompson and the great dialogue from Kelly Thompson for Barda and that kind of relationship, almost like a humorous buddy cop movie with Barda and Cassandra Cain, the Batgirl. And so This continues to be fantastic. I just love Kelly Thompson. I think she gives, especially female characters, such great voices. So oftentimes, like the voice, the way they speak, the cadence, their choice of dialogue, choice of vocabulary that Kelly Thompson gives characters. I think she's the best for Captain Marvel, for Carol Danvers. And I'm quickly becoming starting to think the same thing with Black Canary. Like, I'm not going to want anybody but Kelly Thompson to write Dinah. Less so with Barbara Gordon, because I've probably read a lot more Barbara Gordon Oracle. Not that Kelly's doing a bad job, but I wouldn't say that Kelly already for me is the defining voice for Oracle. But it's starting to feel like she's already the defining voice for me on Black Canary. I just love it. And it goes hand in hand with the gorgeous art that Javier Pena has given us on this issue as well. And in terms of covers, I think there's been a lot of fantastic covers this week. I didn't mention it on Batman First Night. I should have. There's a lot of great covers. But this issue of Black Canary has some amazing covers. There's a Open Order, cover C, Pablo Villalobos, that's amazing. And then there's Women's History Month. March is Women's History Month, from Soza Mica, that has Black Canary, and it has a border where it almost makes it look like a trading card, if you will. Yeah.
It's gorgeous.
That cover's fantastic. And then the regular cover's great as well. So this is probably for covers, probably my favorite. Yeah. I've met Villalobos. I met him last year at San Diego Comic-Con for the first time. And he mentions Adam Hughes as kind of an influence on his art. And you can see that he's kind of got slickness that it
can, you can see it, the face on the smiles of the women, especially Harley Quinn on that cover. It looks like Adam Hughes if you didn't know better.
And it's gorgeous. So yeah, I'm a big fan of what's going on here. Still very curious about this future MAPS Mizuguchi Meridian character. We haven't learned a lot, although we've gotten some hints that she hasn't always made the best choices, and it's led, like, maybe what's going on right now is her fault. I guess we'll see. Kelly Thompson is just brilliant. She's such a fantastic and talented writer. I don't think she gets enough credit nearly for what she does, but, I'll let you talk about that page and, Birds of Prey in bathing suits. What are your thoughts on it?
Yeah. Well, let me just say about Kelly Thompson. What I like that she's got no, she actually, I really appreciate when female writers do this. When they remember that when they write female characters, that these are sexy female characters. And I like when they remember that there's Pyrian fanboys like me that like when when women show some skin in comic books, there is a way to do it with class. And this issue is a prime example of that. And and it's very sort of tongue in cheek, and it's done with sort of a giggle and a laugh. But yet it's also done with a high degree of verisimilitude, because the Birds of Prey are going undercover. Vixen owns a company called MJM Enterprises. Real name is Mari McCabe, but MJM Enterprises, she's a fashion designer. And essentially somebody's going around whoever this person is traveling to the time stream that might be trying to kill Barbara Gordon might also have something against the Birds of Prey and all former members of the Birds of Prey, because somebody has been apparently trying to destroy Vixen's empire, fashion empire, by trying to manipulate and control various people who have worn Vixen's fashion line, which sounds kind of crazy, but it makes sense when you read it in the context of the comic. I won't read it all for people, but it makes a lot of sense. This is, I like this because there's, the conversation here is great. Kelly Thompson nails the voices of these characters, and it's just, it's an enjoyable read. And, you know, I gotta say, as a guy, sometimes I, how do I put this politely? Some people, I don't like how some writers will script dialogue between women where they're just sort of yapping away and it's like watching a bad episode of The Bachelorette where they're just sort of like, you know, the conversations are going nowhere and it's like, oh, like this or that. The Kelly Thompson gives voices to these characters where there's a point to their conversation. And when they're funny, they're funny. And it, and there's a point to every bit of dialogue, no matter how innocuous, because it actually, it says something about the character. There's a fantastic page, and it's there's 12 panels on the page where it shows Vixen and Cassandra Cain, and Vixen's trying to figure out what to put, what fashion to create for Cassandra Cain. And it just, it's perfect because Vixen's doing all the talking and Cassandra Cain, Kelly Thompson gets it right. Cassandra Cain is not a talker. She doesn't say a word. It's just lets Javier Pena's art speak for itself. Gorgeous colors by Jordi Belair. And at the end, you see the outcome of just how gorgeous these characters look when they're drawn up. And this is almost like this feels like a good combination. This is like Barbie with action figures, but it's done. It's entertaining. It's fun, and we know a lot's at stake. And I also find such a clever way for Kelly Thompson to leave Barbara Gordon as Oracle, so she doesn't muddy up the scene by having Barbara Gordon be Batgirl here. She lets Cassandra Cain be Batgirl, and Barbara Gordon stays as Oracle, and it makes sense that she's going to stay behind the scenes and control that. So there's a good in-story explanation for that that doesn't take away from those people who might really prefer Barbara Gordon as Batgirl. It's a very good explanation as to why she needs to be Oracle in this adventure. And there's a wonderful scene where even Black Canary, Dinah, mentions how she misses the voice in her ear. And so does Oracle. And it's a nice callback to those of us who love these characters. We know exactly what they mean. Because I miss the voice in Black Canary's ear too, being Oracle. I mean, all of us BOP fans miss that. And it's really well done. And I got to give Kelly Thompson credit because, you know, I don't know how familiar as she was with these characters, but whatever she did, whether she was always familiar with them or she just did her homework, kudos, because this feels really good. I'm even impressed with maps with Meridian, this older Meridian. I mean, we're getting the adventures of Meridian in sort of backup anthologies and in Brave and the Bold, where a younger Maps adventures. This was a woman who, when she was younger, a young girl at Gotham Academy, young Meridian, she wanted to be the next Robin for Batman, and she grows up to be Meridian. There's so much more we don't know about her. And we learn about her that she gets her powers of time travel from the green, and the potential villain is utilizing the power of the red. So what villain has knowledge of the green and time travel? I don't know. So that's a question for those of us. We can speculate which DC supervillain knows something about the green, knows something about time travel. Off the top of my head, I'm not really sure, but I want to find out. So Kelly Thompson is sort of challenging me, a longtime DC reader, and I'm sitting here and I'm dumbfounded, and I'll probably feel like a fool when the villain's revealed and I'm going to go, aha, of course. So yeah, all around, I really enjoyed this issue. This was a lot of fun and in my top three for pick of the week.
Yeah. I mean, the fact that we have time travel and somehow the green and the red are mixed up in it, who could the character be? Like, it's so organic, right? It's so the green and the red always leans in more to the horror side of DC, yeah, rather than the kind of sci-fi time travel part. So yeah, how is this all going to tie together? I don't know, but I trust that Kelly Thompson's going to make it work. All right. Speaking of the green, up next we have Poison Ivy, issue number 20, written by G. Willow Wilson. Marcio Takara is the artist, Arif Prianto on colors, Hassan Osman Elhau on letters. The Gardner character, Bella Garten, that we saw in Batman, I think it was in James Tynan, Batman 107, James Tynan's run. We get her kind of origin, her first appearance chronologically in the DC universe here, where she shows up, kind of becomes the third leg on the stool between Woodrue and Pamela Isley, or a third part of the love triangle, if you'd rather put it that way.
I'd rather put it that way.
Yeah. But going back and exploring the kind of the early story of Poison Ivy and Jason Woodrue and what have you, I think I really enjoy that this is the direction that DC decided to take this, and to have G. Wilson writing it. Because what it's doing, you know, I just mentioned earlier how I'm not a big fan when DC takes villains and makes them heroes. But with this context, with this explanation, with this, I won't say it's a rewriting or a reboot of Poison Ivy's origin, but it's more like fleshing it out in more detail. You can see why she would be conflicted. You can understand her motivations. You can see how she was hurt and went through trauma, was taken advantage of by others, and that there might be some backlash, that the pendulum might swing the other way, and she might be more willing to protect plants than humans at one point. So it's making a lot of sense. The art by Takara, again, I'm not the biggest fan of his style because it's kind of a messy style, very sort of scritchy and visceral, but it really works when you start talking about plants and kind of this organic feel and a little bit of body horror as well that the Poison Ivy series has. So I'm really enjoying this. I can say, like, when they announced that Poison Ivy was going to have an ongoing, actually, I think it was originally announced as a mini, like a 6-issue, and they just kept extending it. I wasn't real excited because I wasn't a big fan of the character. I still wouldn't say I'm a huge Poison Ivy fan, but I feel like G. Willow Wilson is creating a character and doing the character development so well that I sort of can't help but be pulled in and feel like I understand the character more, like the character is being presented in a very relatable way. And so she feels a little bit more real and less two-dimensional. And again, the fact that she's going back and pulling in characters like Jason Woodrue and Bell and Garten, the gardener. And even we had Alec Holland and June Holland in previous issues. So yeah, I'm really impressed. I'm very impressed by what G. Willow Wilson is doing. And it's going to be hard not to say. It's hard not to say now. And I really think by the time it's over, it's going to be impossible not to say this is going to be kind of the defining series for Poison Ivy as a character, I would think. So what are your thoughts on it, Rocky?
Well, I think you're right. It is going to be the defining series. I think that's clearly where it's going. I have mixed feelings about it. But what I can't deny is that J. Willow Wilson she's done a really good job here. This has been an organically well-paced development of her iteration, her interpretation of Pamela Isley. Now, I have mixed feelings about it but at the same time, I can understand the motivations. I got to be careful playing script doctor here and review the story that's told as opposed to I want. I still have mixed feelings about Alec. Pretty much everybody who loves plants or plant-based heroes or villains went to the same university together. Alec Holland, his wife, Jason Woodrue, Pamela Isley, and now this Bella who will go to eventually become the gardener, Tinian's character. They all went to the same place. And I find that kind of funny and convenient, but yet, dad damn if it doesn't kind of work. And, you know, Pamela, this idea that Pamela Isley was this, she's obsessed with Jason Woodrue, is in love with Jason Woodrue. She wants to impress her professor. And I don't know how much more of a jerk Jason Woodrue needs to be. He manipulates Pamela, he sleeps with her, and yet she seems to know exactly. I mean, J. Willow Wilson, it's very, very curious. J. Willow Wilson is she's very careful to make it clear that Pamela is consenting to her relationship with Jason Woodrue, despite the fact that he's clearly abusive toward her. And yet she makes it clear that, you know, Pamela in the exposition, when Pamela is narrating her own thoughts, it's clear that Pamela is aware that Jason's kind of a jerk, but she kind of loves him, or she wants to impress him. And that it's such an unhealthy, ridiculously dysfunctional relationship. I'm not sure what we were never privy to Pamela Isley growing up, what would make her so vulnerable to be attracted to such a a-hole like Jason Woodrow. And then when Bella shows up, and Bella is a better student. So right away, Pamela Isley is not the smartest. She's not really genius level. She's not the smartest student. She's just sort of average. She's more love struck. She's a very intelligent, maybe B+, A- student, but Bella's the A+ student who will become the gardener. She ends up, you know, Bella ends up getting close to Jason Woodrow, and then Jason sees Bella's just as intelligent or more intelligent than Pamela, and then he uses Bella, and both Pamela and Bella are both being used. Pamela and Bella end up sleeping together while Pamela is still sleeping with Jason Woodrow. I got to say, this is a very adult tale, and J. Willow Wilson manages this relationship very well. I believed it. This is something that, despite the fact that I don't necessarily like this sort of weaker version of Pamela Isley, I can understand it because I'm thinking to myself, okay, she's being manipulated here, but at the end here, where she decides to basically, I mean, you could see how far Pamela has fallen because she's so desperate to please Jason and try to appear smarter than Bella. And she slept with both of them that she's willing to let Jason Woodrow experiment on her. And she can see what his experimentations have done to him. He looks disgusting and gross. And she's willing to be his willing guinea pig just to get closer to him, to prove she's better than Bella. It's kind of, it's pathetic in multiple levels. And yet in a way, yeah, I guess you can kind of see that. But, and then I'm thinking to myself, well, I know Pamela. See, this is a fundamental change from the Poison Ivy that I'm accustomed to, because I'm still inclined to think Poison Ivy, this is her origin story. Well, Poison Ivy goes on to be an eco-terrorist, but I'm wondering, is that going to change too? Because Poison Ivy is clearly end up going to be, she's going to be hurt, she's going to be manipulated. We know from stories in Detective Comics that she's got a dysfunctional relationship, a modern-day relationship with the gardener. And we know that she hates Jason Woodrow. So she's going to somehow evolve from this innocent girl who's clearly being manipulated into an eco-terrorist and then come full circle again. So J. Willow Wilson is really putting her through the ringer here. And goddamn, if it doesn't work. I find myself sort of being swayed, because when this series began, I thought, damn, this is decompressed. It's dragging on. I want her to be evil, but she's not. But this is winning me over just through good characterization. And so, yeah, I still got mixed feelings, but I'm inclined to agree with you that this works. J. Willow Wilson's done a really good job. And Marcio Takara, the art's fantastic. Eric Pianto on the colors. This is haunting. This is disgusting and yet beautiful. And the facial expressions between Bella and Jason Woodrow, the anger of Jason Woodrow, the jealousy of Pamela Isley, the sort of the indifference and yet concern of Bella, and her arrogance and the inherent narcissism that all three of the characters have. It's all there on the page visually. And there's just enough dialogue that it doesn't detract from the art. And it just really works well. And so, yeah, I find myself sort of torn, but at the same time, you know, it just goes to show you that even my preconceptions, I can be won over by good writing. And that's what I've been, kudos to J. Willow Wilson for that here.
Yeah, one of the things I think you mentioned Woodrow looking so, you know, disgusting at the end. And yeah, Pamela was still sleeping with him. I'm like, so you know, this didn't just happen overnight. You know, he's got all these like growths coming out of him or whatever.
Yeah, I know.
So that was like, I guess maybe the lights came, you know, were off before the clothes came off or what have you. Yeah. Then there's also the, you know, 12-year-old in me that wants to make the bad joke, you know, eventually becomes the Floronic Man. And I mean, one thing you can say, the guy's got wood, right?
Yeah.
So attraction.
Yes, that's right.
To Pamela Isley and Bella Gardner. Bucky's got that same 12-year-old potty sense of humor as me, so I knew he would get a kick out of that. Meanwhile, there's other people that heard it and they're groaning. But anyway, let's move on. Up next, we have Blue Beetle number 7, written by Josh Trujillo. Adrian Gutierrez handles kind of the spine story, but then we also have art from Natasha Bustos, Howard Porter, Cully Hamner, and Scott Collins as Blue Beetle and Jaime Reyes jump around the time stream. Will Quintana, Bustos, Hi-Fi, Laura Martin, and Luis Guerrero handle the colors, and Lucas Gattoni on letters. So this felt a little bit anticlimactic, this story. We've had basically one arc of Blue Beetle so far where it's been one story of him taking on the Blood Scarab, and that came to a conclusion last time in the midst of that story, or it might even have been at the end of the Josh Trujillo limited series of Blue Beetle. Ted Kord went missing. So now that the Blood Scarab has been defeated, although there's still fallout and consequences to be dealt with that, specifically how Khaji Da kind of took over and was – instead of Jaime Reyes being in charge, Khaji Da was in charge and using his body like a puppet, for lack of a better term. And so Jaime's very concerned about that. But he finally does have a chance to team up with Booster Gold and go find Ted Kord. So they hop around through various points of time of the DCU here, and they're able to bring Ted back, which is great to see. But there's also it's clear that Josh Trujillo has a lot of plans, a lot of big plans going forward. Blue Beetle continues to sell well, even though the movie didn't do well, unfortunately, because I thought it was fantastic. But it remains to be seen how much time Trujillo is going to have and if we're going to be able to get these stories fleshed out. Because I'm a big fan. I mean, as much as I like Jaime Reyes as a character, and again, I thought that movie was brilliant, Ted Kord is my Blue Beetle, man. I love Ted Kord. I love Ted Kord, you know, with Blue Beetle, and they play off each other really well, but I like Ted Kord more so even on his own. Like that series that started in 86 that had art by Paris Cullins, I think Len Wein wrote it all, if not most of it. But man, I just loved that series, and I was so disappointed when it got canceled, but I think it ran for 26 issues, but I just loved that series. And that was Kord on his own. That was before the Justice League era, Justice League International era, where we got Giffen and DeMatteis and McGuire, and that's where the whole first Blue and Gold started, the humor of the two. But hopefully we get a little bit more Ted Kord going forward, because again, I do like Jaime Reyes, but the Ted Kord Blue Beetle is my Blue Beetle, and it's great to see him back in the book. I thought the art was pretty clean in this one. Gutierrez, you know, goes up and down for me. Sometimes I feel like a little bit too much of that ink splatter. But also, we didn't get as much Gutierrez art because we had those other guest artists jump on, which was a little jarring. I mean, they tried to make it make sense with them each drawing kind of a different time period. And so it worked in that way. But yeah, I'm always going to be 99% of the time I'm going to be a fan of keeping the same artist on the book throughout. So anyway, Blue Beetle continues to be fantastic. And I think Trujillo does a fantastic job of giving it a similar feel to the movie, very youthful feel. And also kind of similar to the movie where Victoria Kord was kind of the antagonist. Yeah, we get some, I'll guess, some malevolent intimations from here that she's not, you know, even though her brother's back and he's a hero, she definitely is not. She, and I wouldn't go so far as to say she's a villain either, but she's very much out for herself. She's out for herself. She's going to do what's best for her. In her mind, what's best for Kord Industries, which in her mind is whatever's best for her personally. So very, very selfish, self-centered, you could almost say greedy character. So you can understand her motivations 100%. So good characterization for her from Trujillo as well. What are your thoughts on the latest issue of Blue Beetle, Rocky?
Well, just to first talk about Victoria Kord, what Josh Trujillo did well in the first, in the first arc was Victoria Kord helped. She helped defeat the Red Scarab. She helped all the Beetles defeat the Red Scarab, and because of that, Natita, who is Roma Lopez, Natita, she she doesn't want to be the Green Beetle anymore. And at the end of this issue, she goes to Victoria Cord and asks that Victoria Cord's help to remove the beetle from her if she can do that. And so, you know, that's the big thing here. Well, what is Victoria Cord going to do if she ends up with the Green Beetle power? And so it's she's always Victoria is, you know, it's an interesting character because she you could tell she was quite sad when her brother when Ted Cord, her brother, was almost killed by the Red Scarab. And, you know, we know she has feelings, but we also know she's got her own agenda all the time. And so she's always a little bit of a wild card. She's not pure evil, but she's not pure good either. But yet she hasn't really gone full evil yet. And so I'm really curious to see what the future holds for the character. As for the rest of the issue, I'm going to admit that I was a little bit confused. I think Josh, writer Trujillo was basically, he was trying to, I guess, trying to be funny I didn't quite understand how Ted Cord was lost, and they needed to triangulate his position because he's lost in time. So they needed three anchor points, and they planted an anchor point during the Justice League International days, and then the Legion days. I'm not even familiar I didn't know Blue Beetle had an affiliation with the Legion. I didn't recognize any of those characters. So I was lost, and the art didn't help. I can't identify a single one of the characters on the Legion page. I don't know who any of those characters were. So I was lost, and I don't know when in the DC timeline that was. That's just me, but I was lost, and even Maxwell Lord during the GLI times, I didn't understand this anchor point thing. It didn't make a lot of sense to me. And then out of the blue, which I thought was actually the funniest moment throughout the entire comic, which I thought was really surprising, we have this Johnny DC continuity cop, which is this stick figure. I mean, this reminds me of Miss Minutes on the MCU on Loki, you know, Miss Minutes. And, you know, this is Johnny DC, the continuity cop, giving Blue Beetle shit for screwing up because his continuity is too convoluted. And it was and then, you know, I like how Jamie Reyes explains, well, you know, Dan was magic, Ted Cord is science, and I'm both. Well, that does simplify it. That doesn't help with continuity. And then I like when the Johnny DC leaves, she says, now I got to go deal with the Huntress. I thought that's perfect. And you could add Power Girl into that mess too. But I thought it was funny. But so I thought was funny. This was a very jarring shift from previous issues because this whole thing was kind of a joke issue. Johnny DC, you know, showing up really threw me for a loop. Now, to my knowledge, I think that's the first appearance of Johnny DC. I'm probably wrong, but is this the first appearance of Johnny DC? Are we going to see this character again? Because it's kind of funny. It's clearly breaking the fourth wall, but yet... I don't know. We got the Time Masters. We got Booster Gold always breaks the fourth wall, or at least from time to time does. And we got various characters that do that. Ambush Bug's in this issue. He breaks the fourth wall from time to time. He did that in Suicide Squad for months, a couple years ago. And so I don't know. Is this the first appearance of Johnny DC, or has Johnny DC appeared lots? I'm going to have to Google that. I don't know. People can leave comments in it to educate me. If I did see Johnny DC in the past, I've long forgotten. But I was a little confused by this issue, but I still have fun with it. And it's clear that the writer has fun too. So it's not bad.
Yeah. As far as I know, this is the first appearance of Johnny DC continuity cop, which I thought was kind of interesting. Because it, you know, kind of meta, not so unlike the Bruno Redondo, Harley Quinn series that we had previously. So I think that worked, really, really well. But yeah, I mean, you're right. The whole Ted Cord missing. And so basically my understanding from Trujillo, from kind of the context of what Booster Gold was saying is so he got pulled through time, but not into any one place. He was almost like his being was split up amongst different times, and that's why they needed the anchors to get different parts of him and pull him back together into one single being. That's an interesting concept. We didn't get into the details of how that would work or what have you, but that was my understanding. But yeah, I could see why it might be confusing for some. All right, on to the last book we're going to talk about in detail. It's Superman 78, The Metal Curtain, issue number 5 from writer Robert Venditti. Art is by Gavin Goodry, colors by Jordi Belair, letters by David Lamphere. This just continues to be a really fun story that captures the feel and essence of the Christopher Reeve version of Superman really, really well. We've got Lois, we've got her father showing up for the first time, we've got them meeting up with Lex. You know, you were right on the nose when you said this armor that Metallo is wearing was created by Lex. We find out how the Russians got it. They basically tricked Lex into thinking he was dealing with the U.S. government, but it was the Russian government. I don't know how you say you're the most brilliant guy in the world, Lex, when you keep making dumbass mistakes like that. But then Superman goes to Russia, and again, capturing the Cold War era feel very well. He goes to Russia, and all he does is just land in Moscow, and people just freak out. And they use it as the Russian army and Russian government uses it as an excuse. I guess I should say the Soviet government uses it as an excuse saying, you know, look at this act of aggression, Western aggression, whatever. Like, the guy's just landing there to try to have a conversation because he knows at some point Metallo's going to attack again. And he doesn't know how he's going to be able to fight him off because the way he defeated him last time with that kind of kill switch on the armor, that's been removed by the Soviet government. So the quote unquote weakness of the armor has been removed. So again, it's a simpler type of story, but it makes sense for the version of Superman that it is. And although the art again is more of a simple style, I think it works for the story that's being told. Really curious to see how this all plays out. And you could really see it working on the big screen, especially with some of the special effects limitations of the late 70s and early 80s. You can still see this on the big screen. So yeah. What are your thoughts on it?
Well, actually, I thought this whole series I thought was a little bit too, I thought predictable to me. But this issue is my favorite so far. And that's because of what saved it is Lex Luthor showing up. I mean, he shows up. He's got basically two hookers on, you know, he's got a hooker on each arm. And he's, you know, he's as arrogant and as narcissistic as ever. Obviously, he takes credit for the fact that he built the machine, built the armor that, of course, could potentially kill Superman. He takes credit for the fact that it didn't because, I mean, he could, you know, he revealed the kill switch. He takes credit for all the good stuff that makes him look good. And it's not his fault if anything goes wrong. And he's just, of course, as Lex Luthor says, he's the most diabolical criminal prodigy of the day, the most menacing criminal mastermind. And I love, of course, you get the characterization of Superman knowing he tells General Lane, he tells Lois Lane that he's going to fly to Moscow and confront Metallo, and he's going to talk with him, and he's going to try to do that. And it's clear that he could die from this. And so he says, he tells Lois he's got to do this, and he tells her that, you know, if I don't make it back, you know, there's certain people that will tell you other things that you don't know about me, and I gotta go. And then as Superman flies off, my favorite line in the entire comic, as Superman flies off, he says to Lois, thanks for everything. And then Lex Luthor says, don't mention it. I mean, to me, that's just classic Lex, you know, always butting in, taking credit for everything, ruining even the best of moments. I mean, that's Lex Luthor, and that's Gene Hackman's Lex Luthor. That's Gene Hackman's. Let me make that clear. That's not mainstream Lex Luthor, mainstream DC Universe Lex Luthor. That's just Gene Hackman Lex Luthor. And it's amazing how it can still put a smile on my face. And, you know, full props to Robert Venditti for channeling that and making this absolutely feels exactly like the Christopher Reeve Superman story. He got the homework assignment. He knew what he was doing. And frankly, my only criticism is that I just find, frankly, I even find some of those Superman movies, not the original first two, but Superman 3 and everything subsequent to that, I just find a little bit passe and boring. But, you know, he's managed to entertain me this issue. And yeah, I enjoyed it. I thought the cover too was very well done, with, you know, showing the intimacy and the connection between Lois and Clark with the Metallo symbol in the back. I thought it worked. I thought it was very poignant, and it, you know, I bitch and complain a lot about how covers don't always reflect the content of the comic books anymore, especially on the variant covers. But this is a cover A that I think does a very good job of conveying the content, and it does a really good job.
Yeah, I think it does. It's fantastic. So there's a few other issues. So Batman and Scooby-Doo Mysteries Volume 3 is also out. The Blue Beetle has a Spanish language edition as well. And then there's a ton of collections this week. We've got Action Comics Volume 1, Rise of Metallo. So that collects Action Comics 1051 to 1056. That's during the Philip K. Johnson run. We've got Green Arrow Volume 1. Issues 1 through 6, so that collects the Joshua Williams and Sean Isaacs run. Batman Wayne Family Adventures Volume 3, which collects the Webtoon episodes, issues 52 through 72. We've got Batman Beyond, the animated series, Classic Compendium, 20th Anniversary Edition. How's that for a mouthful? And that collects Batman Beyond Volume 1, 1 through 6, Volume 2, 1 through 24, and also, which the second series has never been collected before. And then a guest appearance from Superman Adventures number 64. We've got another Night Terrors, this time Terror Titans hardcover, which collects a bunch of the Night Terror stories. The Titans, Night Terrors, Shazam, Night Terrors Black Adam, Night Terrors Angel Breaker, and Night Terrors Ravager. We've got Red Hood Outlaws Volume 1, which collects Volume 1 through 10 of the Webtoon. Again, DC teaming up with Webtoon for some of these stories. Harley Quinn Volume 3, which collects issues 13 through 17 of the Harley Quinn run that Stephanie Phillips did. And Superman Emperor Joker hardcover, which collects that Emperor Joker story from the 2000s, written by Jeff Loeb, art by Jeff McGinnis. I'm not going to read off the issues. It's a ton of Superman issues. Adventures of Superman, Action Comics, Superman, the Man of Steel, a crossover into all those things. Then we've got Batman Incorporated Volume 2, Joker Incorporated. That's the Ed Brisson series. This collects the second half of it, 7 through 12, which we really enjoyed. And then finally, Vixen NYC Volume 4, which is another Webtoon collection, this time collecting episodes 29 through 38 of that Webtoon. So, ton of collections this week. Hopefully there's something that tickles your fancy. And yeah. That does it for the collections and our thoughts on this week's issues. So, time for Book of the Week, Rocky. Is it easy? Is it hard? Any idea what you're going to choose?
I want to explain in a very quickly why it's very difficult this week. I thought Poison Ivy was very well done. It impressed me. I thought Batman 145 made me think about the Joker. So I was made to think about reevaluate Poison Ivy. It made me reevaluate the Joker. And these are all in good ways or mixed feeling ways. Comic books that makes me think. I love The Birds of Prey. Kelly Thompson is impressing the hell out of me. I love Zod. I love The Death of Ursa. It was such action packed. I love Batman the Knight. So those are five that are very tough to choose from. But I got to pick one and I'm not going to shy. And I got to go with, I'm going with Zod. It's my pick of the week. The other ones are so close. A close second would be Batman the Knight. But for the impact and it was so well done. And I have to go with Zod. So what about yourself?
Yeah, that's a great pick. And, you know, I started off the episode by saying my pick was super easy. And then as I talked about some of these others, Poison Ivy, Zod, I realized it was closer than I thought, but I'm still going to stay with my original pick. And that's the Batman First Night. From Dan Jurgens and Mike Perkins. Maybe part of my choice is colored by the fact I had such an amazing chat with them. Again, highly encourage you guys to go take a listen, get some insights, some behind the scenes. I especially loved what they had to say about how Mike Spicer was going to color it originally, and then the reason that there was a change and why they went a different direction. I thought that was really interesting. But the strength of the story, it's not just that it's fleshing out the original origin of Batman back in the 30s and playing into a lot of the real world events that were happening at that time and the socio-political climate of that time. But just the fact that visually it also ties in so well. I mean, a lot of people, when they think of Batman, they were introduced to Batman, they became a Batman fan or what have you. So many people from my generation and younger it's the Batman the Animated Series. And they may not have the graphic language to describe it in terms of stylistically what it looked like or what have you, but it's called Art Deco. That really clean sort of in this country, late 30s into the 40s, and started evolving into something else during the 50s. But that really kind of clean retro look that so many people associate with the look of Batman the Animated Series. We talk about that, Mike Perkins and I, as well as Dan Juergens, and you can see it on the title page in here as well, that Art Deco influence. And Mike talks about trying to influence that into the story, but then also realizing it's a story of you know, a city that's suffering from poverty and homelessness and that sort of thing. But I find that incorporating that into this really sort of gritty street level narrative that's being told, and that balance that Mike found in the first issue, it's just done so well. It's just a brilliantly done comic. It shows the power of what Black Label can be, because it doesn't have to tie into continuity. But then, like Dan says, but there's nothing in here that won't tie into continuity, because when you go back and look at those earliest Golden Age stories, there's not a lot there that is still considered, you know, in continuity or can't be changed or what have you. So it's brilliantly done. Highly recommend picking it up. It's worth the price of admission for the art alone, but you're also going to get a fantastic story. So that's my pick. All right. So I mentioned the Tom King, Daniel Sempere interview. That'll be coming up later this week. Daily Spawn is continuing as well. You guys really seem to be enjoying that. See, the episode views continue to increase. So we'll keep doing it. Really appreciate you guys showing up for that. And then I had a couple other interviews later at the end of last week. Gungnir, which is the name of Odin's spear. There's a company called Gungnir Books that's coming out. Steve Orlando, Michael Medney, Jim Kruger, they had a lot of great things to say. One of the things I love about them, everything's hardcover, everything's fantastic art, gorgeously colored. But because everything is hardcover, you're never going to have a single issue. Everything is always, here's the complete collected story. You know, if they divided it up, it would maybe be six issues or whatever. They decided not to do that. They're going to release everything as graphic novels, complete stories, what have you. And it may be sometimes multiple volumes of graphic novels to get an even bigger story, but each individual graphic novel will be a complete story. So again, go check it out. Fantastic chat with them. And I have some more interviews coming up this week. So appreciate you guys tuning in. Rocky, you have any other content coming out that you want to tease?
Not specifically. Nothing I want to talk about. If I, I'm not going to say anything. I'll just jinx it. So, maybe I'll coordinate with you something this week. We'll see.
Yeah, we keep talking about wanting to get that review done for the second issue of Ultimate Spider-Man. So maybe we'll be able to get that done. Yeah, it's definitely worth chatting about. So anyway, that's going to do it for this episode, everybody. Don't forget to head over to YouTube if you're listening to the audio only. Do a search for Rocky's channel so you can see our smiling faces and the gorgeous art. Comic Space Boom! ! Is where you can find him. Ring the notification bell, subscribe, leave some comments. We get some good conversations going in the comment section many times. Look for Spawn Daily. Head over to the Comic Source YouTube channel. And then if you want to check out our back catalog, the thousands of episodes, audio only, just go to wherever you get your podcast from, whatever platform or app works for you. Do a search for the Comic Source and subscribe. So again, we appreciate you tuning in, everybody, and we'll talk to you next time.
Catch you later.
You can find the Comic Source podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.